All right. Hi, everybody. It's RCFB Talk 73. We're taking your calls tonight. It's Tuesday night, and we want to hear from you. There has been stuff happening in the college football universe. This is a chance to hear from you and talk about it. As we get ready to set up right now, I wanted to mention we have a really exciting Twitter space that we just scheduled for tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning, we'll be joined by Sun Belt Commissioner Keith Gill. And that's going to be interesting because, I mean, the Sun Belt, as we all know, had that incredible weekend where they upset, you know, three major teams, and the belt is rising. I mean, I think they won conference realignment. We've talked that quite a bit in the offseason with some of their additions. Let me go ahead and add our co-hosts. We're going to have an interesting lineup tonight. Let's see here. And then, so that'll be tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific. So, hey, you know, the good news is these are automatically recorded and we'll get them on podcast form as well. So that should be fun to talk with Commissioner Gill about the Sun Belt. All right. My name is Bob Akhayeri. I'm going to be joined by Sirius and I'm going to be joined by guest host Chris Darrett. So let me go ahead and invite them. I just invited Chris. I can see we already have someone queued up, so I'll get you up here in a moment. Let me go ahead and actually send that. All right, there we go. And then there's Sirius. There's my co-host. All right. Excellent. All right. So, gentlemen, are you up here? My co-hosts, Chris and Sirius. How are you doing?
Doing great. Ready to talk some football. And here's some caller questions.
Absolutely. Chris, how are you doing tonight?
Yeah, doing great as well. It was a fun week of college football and ready to jump into it.
Excellent. Yeah, I think, and just to say, I think this is wonderful. What a lovely way to start with some great upsets and all of that stuff. That's what we love about the sport. But anyway, Benjamin, you've been patient. What's up? We'd love to hear from you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I guess I sort of have a two-pronged question, if you guys are willing to entertain it.
Of course.
Awesome. So, I'm a bit sick, so I'm not sure. I might not be able to articulate too well, but I'm a Kentucky fan, and I guess, you know, coming off such a major win, the first part of my question would be, like, what do you see this season, where do you see, like, what do you think Kentucky's ceiling is? Which I guess sort of leads into the second part of my question was sort of in the wake of the Scott Frost departure from Nebraska. Mark Stoops, his name was thrown around quite a bit, you know, not seriously, but, you know, it was listed on, you know, in certain college football circles as a potential candidate, which sort of evoked this conversation of, like, what is Kentucky as a program right now and how does it stack up to, say, a Nebraska? And I think Mark Stoops has put us in a very interesting place. I'd love to hear from someone outside the sort of Kentucky sphere, like, how Kentucky is viewed. Where do you think this program is going, and is it sustainable, I guess, several coaches on? Or is this just sort of, you know, is this special? Is this, you know, exceptional? Thank you.
Well, first off, you know, got to say, go Cavs, go Big Blue Nation. Big time win over Florida this past weekend. Like, it cannot be understated just how much of an impact that has, being able to go into, you know, face Florida and come away with a win, because I know that's something that Kentucky has really struggled with in the past. So just being able to get that win is huge. As for what the ceiling is, I mean, if you look back at the last two times that Mark Stoops has beat Florida, They won 10 games those years. So I think that once you get past that hurdle, the confidence booster that presents for your program, I think that's huge. So I think that, you know, a 10-win season is definitely on the table now once you've got that hurdle out of the way. And as for, is Nebraska a step up or, you know, even on the same level as Kentucky is right now, I mean, they're going to have the Big Ten money coming in, which is nothing to laugh about. But at the same time, in terms of where those programs are today, if you're coming into Nebraska, unless you have the big-time resume that is going to, you know, like a Lincoln Riley type move, where recruits are going to flock to you because of what you've shown you can do with these five stars, you know, quarterback development, that kind of thing, you're going to have a lot of, like, program rehabilitation, basically, to do for this Nebraska program. This isn't, you know, coming off of a Tom Osborne dynasty where you're just kind of, you know, revamping every year, reloading every year. This is building it up from the ground, teaching a team what it means to be able to think you can actually win. You don't have as many close losses as Scott Frost had without some serious program issues where players, you know, don't believe that they can finish out games and actually win those games. That starts to build on itself. So you're going to have to do massive, massive program overhaul. Mark Stoops has done that at Kentucky. Like, Kentucky has gone from being, you know, no offense, but kind of like a joke basement dweller, kind of, you know, a step above Vanderbilt, to in the running for second or third in the SEC East, which 20 years ago would have been, you know, inconceivable. Wow. Almost. He's done that development at Kentucky already. And then how much would Nebraska have to offer to be able to say, yeah, we're going to hire you away and make you go through that all over again just to maybe get back to 10 wins, which we haven't seen in a very, very long time. That's just kind of my personal take on it right now. Sounds crazy if you talk to somebody back in the 90s, but Kentucky right now, I think, is a better program than Nebraska when it comes to trying to, you know, hire away talent.
Wow. You know, I'm a little bit more, I think, in the middle from Sirius on this. I think Kentucky is definitely a program on the rise. I mean, that's undoubted. You know, we're going to see, I think, over the season, if they are the real deal this season or if they're on the rise. But I mean, obviously a top 10 team right now is astonishing. Again, you know, I'd love to go back and tell Kentucky fans a while back, you know, that this is coming and this is exciting for them. Now, all of that said, you know, we had a longer conversation, like right after they announced Scott Frost was let go. We had a Twitter space and we were hearing from people, and JD, who couldn't be here tonight, pointed out one of the fascinating things in Stoops' contract at Kentucky is for every win at number 9 and beyond, he gets $250,000. And then he still gets an automatic 1-year extension to his contract at Kentucky if the Wildcats win 7 games in a season. And he gets an automatic 2-year extension for every time the Wildcats get a 10-win season. This is just an incredible contract. I mean, Kentucky knows they have someone that is making them interesting, making them relevant. I mean, we've heard the sort of off-the-field banter between football and basketball. Whoever thought that was going to happen, whether Kentucky is a football or a basketball school, and the coaches get annoyed. I mean, the basketball coach getting annoyed at the football coach. That's incredible for Kentucky. So I do agree, Kentucky may be the more attractive long-term stay. Of course, Nebraska still is a bit of a blue blood. Its name is there. You know, teams will go through long periods of languishing. Alabama certainly did for a while there before Nick Saban proved that they're, you know, turned them into what they are now. And then USC, of course, had some really lean years before Pete Carroll turned them around. And then they kind of had some more lean years. And we'll see how this Lincoln Riley thing goes. It's still a little bit early. But, you know, if they're interested in jumping into, he's interested in jumping into that kind of a circumstance, maybe. I think that's going to be obviously the personality more than anything. But gosh, Kentucky makes a really attractive place to stay just for those reasons. A high salary and those really impressive perks if he just hits 7, 9, or 10 wins. Seriously, I know you wanted to follow up on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch back on that because you had mentioned, you know, Nebraska still has that blue blood reputation. And I don't disagree because you can't win as many games, as many national championships as Nebraska did and not have that reputation. But there's a very big caveat there. You know, if you go back to when we had Bo Pelini on the show earlier this year and we asked him, do you think that Nebraska can get back to where it was? And he flat out said, you know, it's going to be really, really hard because the thing that has changed the most since then is that those Tom Osborne era teams were built off of local talent. And they had a phenomenal strength and conditioning program to train them up and develop them the way that they wanted them to. But with recruiting being such a national game now, even Kentucky being kind of like the edge of the Southeast, you get such a boost in your recruiting options and the fact that you have access to some larger population centers than exist in Nebraska. It's just, it makes a huge, huge difference in being able to quickly turn a program around. Because unless you're one of those big name hires that's flashy, then you're not going to immediately draw those recruits to you. You have to be able to offer the facilities and find the right coaching staff and also offer proven on-field results. Because, if Bama starts turning in, 5-win seasons, that recruiting pipeline dries up because they'll find other places that are going to win and get them on national TV and get them into the pros. So that's one of the big things that shifted since when Nebraska earned that blue blood reputation to now, and what a new coach is going to have to fight against to bring them back to national relevance.
Yeah, seriously, you alluded to it. Excuse me. It brings up a fair, I think, a fair question of the impact of NIL, of the impact that it's going to have on being able to bring athletes to one school or to another. And another question that I kind of had in my own mind as we're having this conversation is, how much collateral does Nebraska have? And I guess I'm not a Gen Zer, so perhaps I am too old to answer this question myself, but how much collateral does Nebraska have on a national level at this point? I know, we know the history of Nebraska, and obviously a giant state school is going to be a big draw for athletes. But now in this day and age, when the very best athletes are having every opportunity to kind of pick and choose the schools that they're going to deem, respectable, and not that Nebraska is not, but that they're going to deem their best options, are they going to choose a Nebraska? And I guess I'm leaving that question kind of open-ended because I'm kind of processing that in my own mind. But even from the days that I was in school in the mid, to late 2000s, Nebraska was still beating the pants off of my alma mater, Baylor. And of late, obviously, the success just hasn't been there. And so I'm wondering how big of a draw is it to the athletes, student athletes, as much as it is even a coaching destination.
Those are great points. Ben, what are your thoughts? You asked us, we'd love to hear yours.
Yeah, sure. I'll share my thoughts and then I'll hang up and listen, let someone else speak. On the Nebraska point, as to, how attractive a program is it for, prospective athletes. One thing I've observed, I'm no expert, but just sort of empirically, is that in this era, the NIL era, in the era where I've noticed a lot of schools are beginning to invest in facilities, schools that previously perhaps weren't massive football schools, anyone can recruit. And, at a face value, that might sound like an advantage for Nebraska, as the type of school that's not particularly close to massive population centers. But I think it's actually a step down from where they were in the 90s when they were competing for national championships because, there was that brief period where, sort of before the NIL transfer portal era that we live in now, where, Nebraska just, there was no hope of them getting 5 stars out of high school. And now I think since there's, anyone really has that ability, you look at, schools like Maryland or even Kentucky, who have sort of been, come out of nowhere, invest in facilities and hire just strong staffs, there are just more schools vying for kids. And I just think it'll be difficult for Nebraska to really assemble a roster like they had been able to in the past. As for sort of Kentucky's presence at a national stage, I think I'll just end on this. Within our division, the SEC East, over the course of the past 5 years, and in some cases it's been much longer than 5 years, we have winning records against all of our I'm pretty sure I'm correct about that, but against all of our division rivals but Georgia, right? So obviously Georgia's this massive hurdle that I'm not even sure if Kentucky can overcome. If we do, beat them, maybe even this year, that's definitely not something that would be able to sustain. Georgia's just this massive football, hegemonic power. But like I think Kentucky is the real deal. I obviously, maybe I'm being a bit hopeful as a Kentucky fan, but like even the fact that we have South Carolina's number, 7 of the last 8, like that's surreal to me. But I feel like that's also sort of overlooked. Like we compete. We compete and we win. I think as long as, as you mentioned, Stoops' contract is just phenomenal, from the perspective of a Kentucky fan as well as from his perspective. As long as we have him at the helm, there's like 2 jobs he'd leave for, in my opinion. I think he'd leave for like Ohio State. which is obviously his home state. You know, if Iowa came calling, maybe even then, now it's less and less probable by the year. And if, like, an Alabama came, which is also very improbable, he'd probably go. But I really like the, you know, the direction our program is going. As for sort of this year, I think the sky's the limit. I think sort of the scuttlebutt, you know, in the Lexington camp is like, you know, we have as good a shot of going to Atlanta this year as we've ever had. As we've had, you know, I don't know if they're playing any sort of SEC championship in Atlanta in the 50s, but since Bear Bryant's been around, you know, this is as good as we've been. So, you know, I'm feeling really good. Thank you all for taking my question and talking to me for a little bit. You guys were all very insightful. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for joining us, man. That was all. We enjoyed hearing your insights as well. So, and then Kentucky's definitely an exciting program this season. We can't wait to see more. Miller, you've been patient. We'd love to hear from you. What's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So, a little early in the season to be thinking about bowl games, but doing it anyways with the win over Texas A&M this weekend, and then looking forward on the schedule for App. The only game I'm seeing they might not be favored in is Marshall. I was wondering if you think they potentially have an inside track at being a G5 team in the New Year's Six Bowl this year. Kind of getting tired of Camellia Bowls and New Orleans Bowls.
Hey, well, first of all, I'm so glad we have an App State caller so early on. That's great. I mean, that's obviously one of those big wins from this weekend for the Belt. And, you know, I'm just going to take a half second and plug the fact that we actually have Sunbelt Commissioner Keith Gill coming on tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Eastern. He's going to be here talking, you know, Sunbelt football after this crazy weekend. So that'll be fun. But jumping into this, I mean, I see what you're saying. You know, the Sunbelt, if anything, I'm actually worried that if I was an App State fan, it is awfully strong this season. So you're right. Certainly Marshall is the other school in the conference that seems the most, you know, likely to be a challenger to App State. But obviously, you know, good old rival Georgia Southern just pulled a big upset in Nebraska. And I know that's not quite the same this season as it would have been. Like Texas A&M wasn't firing Jimbo immediately after the game and eating $7 extra million, you know. So, but at the same time, that wild game against North Carolina. And I, you know, North Carolina fans are probably so happy right now. Because after, you know, week one games, you're just terrified when you see that incredible 63-61 game in Boone. And maybe they're thinking, are we terrible or... And, you know, who knows? I mean, obviously Georgia State gave them a run last week as well and almost became another, you know, Sun Belt upset. But App State, you know, Troy, I'm less concerned about this season. James Madison's a total unknown. They're doing okay, but their competition's kind of meh. It would be a shock if they were to be a big challenger, but you never know. And Old Dominion certainly got their upset over Virginia Tech. But again, you know, they just seem to have Virginia Tech's number because they love any opportunity. They have. It's amazing. Virginia Tech's never actually won at Old Dominion Stadium in the two.
Moving times. On.
So all that said, God, you know, I think with that win at A&M, it's going to be really interesting to see. It would be really exciting if App State and Marshall don't lose before that game in November 12th, because suddenly Marshall will be undefeated and certainly ranked by that point. And you'll have, you know, App State with that exciting win in their, you know, repertoire. And who knows, maybe UNC will start to still be undefeated or at least have a good enough season to have a ranked loss with about, you know, a couple of points. I would love to see. I mean, that almost makes Marshall an attractive game day location. If that, you know, imagine that in Huntington. But we're not. That's far too far in the future to predict that. We were all hot about UTEP and UTSA last year, possibly having that, and then UTEP had to lose. So, all that said, I don't know, guys. What do you think? I mean, I think App State has a very favorable schedule, and if they win out, they're going to be very attractive to be that AQ qualifier for the New Year's Six. Now, I do want to say one of the things the Sun Belt has and they're working on now is probably the bowl tie-ins. The change in the conference lineup almost gives them a much more attractive position. So hopefully when sort of bowl realignment happens, when the bowls start, selecting new tie-ins, the Sun Belt will be able to get that boost and get some more attractive games. Because right now they offer a better lineup than they did when they were originally set up. And I remember how exciting it was, gosh, 8 years ago when, Carl Benson was excited that they had more than one bowl tie-in. It wasn't just in the Orleans Bowl. They were able to get a few more. So, yeah, I agree. The Camellia Bowl and a couple of those are nice bowls, but it gets a little tiresome, and I think it would be nice to see the Sun Belt not have to just hit a New Year's Six or beyond, because obviously the 12-team playoff will open up that possibility, but at least to give them more variety. Chris, serious, what do you guys think?
I agree. I think that, you look around at the other G5 conferences, and the Sun Belt is kind of in the catbird seat at this point with so many undefeated teams, which is always, like every coach says, right? Can't go undefeated if you don't go 1-0, 2-0, 3-0. They're in a great starting point because so many of the other, usual runners that we see from the other G5 conferences, they've already picked up a loss. I mean, Boise State's got a loss. San Diego State's got a loss. Cincinnati, Houston, all of these other, familiar names have already picked up one loss in the season. And Sun Belt sitting here with six undefeated teams plus App State with a very, very, respectable 2-point loss to the UNC in the first game of the year. And then going into College Station and pulling off the upset against A&M. So I think that if there's a conference that's in the position, as long as they don't cannibalize themselves too much, and I think it would definitely help if you've got like a App State and Marshall running the table between now and their matchup, and then like a Louisiana coming out of the West, the Sun Belt West, to provide a good matchup there. I think that really would help set the stage to really propel them up. And if this season gets crazy enough, maybe we're even looking at a Sun Belt team that's potentially pushing up into the top 10 and getting some serious discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that we've got to, acknowledge, whether it was just the state of college athletics, recruiting, transferring, obviously the gap in COVID and such, however we've gotten here, this landscape right now is wild. I mean, it's more wild than it's ever been. And you have so many programs that are putting out really great football. Something that, impressed me about App State the past two weekends, I mean, you look at even the style of games that they won, a style of game they won and a style of game they came up just short, a wild, crazy shootout against UNC. And able to hold Texas A&M to 14 points. They were able to compete in multiple ways at a very high level. And I think that is a indicative of the state of college football that we're in. And we also spoke briefly about that previously in a discussion of Kentucky and Nebraska. Names obviously still are very big and important. But right now, any talented team, we've gotten, I think we're getting to that age where we're getting past the point where it's all about, the name and the history. And I think that fans and players and the media, we're much more open to this landscape that is wilder. And I think we're more welcoming to programs from Group of Five conferences that show that they can play football at a high level. And I think the opportunity is there for them to compete, in the postseason.
So, Miller, what are your thoughts right now? I mean, you've heard ours, and you shared that you're really optimistic about it. Is Marshall the main team you're concerned about, or what others? What do you make of James Madison? I'm curious, because that team, you kind of see it, and they've been sort of hiding in all the din. It's their first season. Do you think they're going to be much of a challenger?
I haven't put too much thought towards James Madison. I actually had a roommate I lived with in college. He's a UNC fan, so he's been happy about that game. But he did say he expects JMU to be a trap game for App. coming off the A&M win and then getting game day for the first time. I don't see it that way, but we'll see. I looking at the schedule, Marshall is the main concern, and then potentially whoever they would have in the conference championship if they make it there.
Yeah. You know, one thing I do remember, and App State was the first Sun Belt team to ever get ranked in the AP a while ago. And the Sun Belt had that happen, had probably habit of having a team rise up and hit that level and then, like, immediately embarrassed, like, just have an embarrassing loss the next week. And I forgot who App State lost to that week. I can't remember if it was Arkansas State or
– I think it was Georgia Southern.
Georgia Southern. It was one or the other. Mm-hmm. I think it was Arkansas State that had there was this weird sort of cycle where a team would rise up and then have this kind of this embarrassing moment. But I think that now we're seeing a maturity in the conference, and those baby steps are paying off, because now it seems they finally built something that can drive forward and be that, make a real play to be a G5, a power. I mean, that was our thought again with the realignment, just watching them and who they selected. They seem to have really found a position of strength that, again, would have been unexpected a decade ago, for sure. Well, Miller, it's great hearing from you always. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it, y'all. Go Appalachian.
Hey, Chris, what's up? You've been patient. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello, everybody. First things first, I want to say this fight on. So my fellow Trojans in here. I have a couple of talking points I want to discuss. Basically, we all know about Scott Frost, and we talk about dynamic coaching trees. I think of one that I think that will work pretty good. They're both offensive guys, pretty good offensive mind gentlemen. And unfortunately, it's the other school across town. I'm currently in Los Angeles, but I think will be a good, happy marriage will be Chip Kelly and him. I just feel like they, you know, him, Chip Kelly being very seasoned, can kind of like get him back on his course again, just like how Nick Saban did with Steve Sarkisian and Lane Kiffin and those people like that. And also, too, this is another interesting talking point as well. What Power 5 conference is going to give Deion Sanders a chance? Man, he's proven himself. Like, you know, he's out there winning. He's winning at Jackson, Mississippi. So, you know, if a big brand gets behind him, he could definitely get the players there, even if it is in Nebraska. You know, who wouldn't want to play for Deion Sanders? Like, that's an easy brain, easy no call. And then also, too, my third piece is basically I want to know who's going to be next on the chopping block. And the only reason why I think of this person is because my sister goes to Tech, Georgia Tech. Jeff Collins, man, it's looking pretty fishy over there at Georgia Tech. So I think he might be up next. I'm not trying to jinx the man, but he got to do some soul searching in that program, because that program is – that could be a powerhouse. They're in the smack dab middle of Atlanta. They could get anybody and anybody that they want, from the ACC to the SEC, from out here. Man, you can't beat that. Who would want to play football in Atlanta? And that's pretty much it. And fight on to my fellow Trojans again.
Hey, Chris, thank you for joining us. And, you know, it's funny, as I tend to say, I'm also a Trojan. So, yeah, fight on to all of you out there who happen to have suffered as USC fans for the last number of years before, you know, things seem to be interesting. I'm always skeptical until I see more wins, but we'll see. I mean, it's definitely different at USC. But you brought up some interesting thoughts. I mean, Chip Kelly, gosh, I know Nick Sirius has some thoughts here too, but we'll see. How that would be an interesting call. We've been talking about, you know, Trev Alberts. He's the AD at Nebraska. This is going to be his defining moment, who he picks to be the head coach of the Huskers now that he gets a chance to select somebody. Chip Kelly, I don't know, especially at this point, after, you know, UCLA, he's kind of, people are sort of surprised he's how long he's going to be there. I mean, he had some just three miserable seasons, and then he got it together last season. Of course, they got into a bowl game, and then they're the team that canceled it. Now, so, but of course, yeah, Scott Fryer. Oh, I see. Oh, would Scott end up at UCLA? Yeah, no. I get it. I'm sorry. I was totally blanking there. That's my own evening there. But, you know, serious, I'll let you step up because I know you had some thoughts on this.
I mean, I don't know if Chip Kelly's tenure is safe enough at UCLA. I don't know, you know, kind of like what kind of a standard that they're looking for. He's had a pretty mediocre run there so far. I mean, winning season last year, which is good, but still overall he's got a losing record. So, you know, if you're in that position, do you really feel safe enough bringing in a guy who just got fired for an absolutely abysmal run at Nebraska, his alma mater, you know, as some kind of an offensive assistant, coordinator, off-field position, you know, wayward home for coaches who can't coach good and want to do other things good too, type position. On the other side, other hand of it, you know, he's going to come cheap because he just got a massive payout from Nebraska. So, you know, he's going to like work for minimum wage, which I assume in LA is going to be like $50 an hour or something stupid. So I guess that's the upside there, but it would be an interesting choice. The Georgia Tech question. Yeah, it's not been a good run for Jeff Collins so far. And I don't know that it looks to be getting any better. But then, you know, they've definitely got to ask themselves, if we fire him, who better can we get? And there's also the question of when you fire them, when you start your search, who else is on the market? Because we've seen schools have probably held off because it looked like it was going to be a crowded coaching search season. Carousel was, you know, full spin by the time they were getting close to making a decision, and they decided to just wait a year. So it's always kind of an interesting side effect, whether or not some other schools pull the plug. Obviously, Nebraska hit the eject button super early in the season. So we kind of interesting to see how that goes. As far as Deion, I mean, I think the biggest question is, does Deion want to move up? Because he's made a big point about trying to recruit more athletes to HBCUs, lift them up, provide them as a platform and an opportunity. And now with, obviously, the NIL opportunities that are available, Deion definitely knows how to market himself and other people around him. So that's going to be a selling point for going to an HBCU where you can tap into that. If he is serious about this, and again, it's just not marketing for him as, you know, Coach Prime. So it'll be interesting to see what his next step is, because like you said, he has proven that he can be successful as a head coach. Does he want to continue this on and build something, or is this just a stepping stone and he's just saying what people want to hear?
Yeah, I do think it'll kind of be a slow boil as far as potentially moving up to the next level. I will say, though, something that has kind of surprised me, you know, again, kind of growing up knowing Deion Sanders, prime time, you know, high-stepping, knows how to brand himself. And I'm sure we've all seen it, you know, at this point. But recently, is addressing his student athletes, trying to tell them, you know, how to go to class and represent yourself well as young men. And it's not to say that I think of Deion Sanders as somebody who's not classy, but I do think, when I think primetime, I think branding, much less than that mentoring role. And so that's kind of pleasantly surprised me. And I think that's going to play well at if he chooses and wants to try to go up to the next level. I think that's going to play in very well, because Power Five schools are going to be looking, especially in this day and age, social media, very easy to get in trouble and be exposed for getting in trouble. That's going to play into being a draw. As far as which team gives him a shot, I'm unsure at this point, only because, again, I think it's going to be at least, you know, a few more seasons of sustained success before we understand both what Power Five schools, how they gauge Deion as a prospect, and as Sirius said, how he gauges his own role as an HBCU champion for that cause and for those schools. But he is saying the right things and doing the right things and coaching his players, I think, the right way. Again, to a surprising level for what we all grew up knowing as, you know, prime time.
You just had me thinking, what would be the – oh, go ahead, Chris, please.
No, brother, my bad. I just wanted to say, so hypothetically, again, Florida State, we all saw that game with LSU. If Florida State doesn't have the year that they promise or they want to have, do you think Florida State will try to reach out to him again?
Boy, that's an interesting question. I mean, certainly he would be an interesting candidate. I don't know if Florida State would quite be willing to take the risk, only because when you think of a school like a Florida State, they would probably want to hire someone who's already kind of made themselves, you know, prove themselves, I should say, at the FBS level. It would be amazing to see them. It would be striking and kind of unexpected to see them do that. I mean, for example, you know, we were just talking about Chip Kelly. For example, I remember how he got into FBS. He was this incredible offensive coordinator up and comer at New Hampshire. I remember that because New Hampshire was putting up some crazy numbers in FCS for a while there. And everyone's like, they've got this offensive coordinator. And then, you know, they get him at Oregon to be their offensive coordinator. And then from there, he became the heir apparent coach. And that's how he kind of landed there. So that's how, you know, and Oregon's arguably not as preeminent as Florida State, especially not at the stage they were at when they promoted Chip Kelly, and not at the stage. Florida State is, you know, a new blue blood, you know, if not, I mean, it's still a premier program. I think that might just worry a lot of folks who might be decision makers there. So I wouldn't say they wouldn't consider it. And he'll certainly be, I think, on any list, but I would be surprised only for that reason. But, you know, I was going to joke that, you know, maybe Nebraska should hire him. Although, because that would be totally – I was like, who would be the less likely candidate, you know, going into your final question about – or your final point about Jeff Collins. And I do agree. I think among people who are left, he's definitely on probably the biggest hot seat over at Georgia Tech, because that's just – those fans are so fed up with him, completely fed up with him, it feels like. So – but the funny thing is, I'm like, where would be the least likely place for him? Would it be Georgia Tech, or would it be Nebraska to see Deion Sanders become the head coach? So just kind of blend all of your points together. But gosh, you know, do either Chris and Sirius, I don't know if you guys wanted to comment on that. I think I like Chris's idea that Tech seems to be one of the likely next candidates to possibly put their coach on the chopping block. I just don't know the nuances of his contract to know if there's a heavy penalty or not. And I don't know if they're necessarily going to feel like a Nebraska and just say, you know, it's worth the $7 million to just fire him a couple of weeks early.
Yeah, as you are unsure on the specifics of the details of the contract, but I think we're getting to a place, you know, getting to a place where it's kind of a broken record. You know, there are knee-jerk reactions, and then there is the frustration that builds over time for lack of success, and that's where Georgia Tech is right now. I mean, it's you never want to say a team is a bye week, but it's getting to the point where they're needing to field just competitive teams at this point on the field, and that's not happening. So yeah, I would definitely agree with Chris. The chopping block is right there, I think.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate touching on all those topics. You brought up several interesting ones. You know, for all of you out here, you're listening to RCFB Talk 73. We're taking your calls about all the things that happened in college football this week. any level, it's all been interesting. I mean, heck, if you wanted to talk about the upset of Mary Harden Baylor in D3 by Wisconsin Whitewater, we're here for you. But Cody, you've been patient. What's up? We'd love to hear from you.
Hey guys, how are we doing this evening?
Great.
Oh, that's awesome, man. That's awesome here. My topics maybe are not as great as Chris's. He kind of, I don't know how I'm going to up that. That was great, what he just said. So one thing, I got two things. One thing is, it's not a big deal maybe to the country, but it is to me as a Trojan. Next week's game, USC Oregon State on the Pac-12 network, easily could be the game of the week, and no one's going to see it. And that, to me, I feel for the Beaver fans and the Trojan fans, as myself as well. I think that's just an atrocity to the sport, and that's a bad way to grow the sport. I think that's going to be a great game to watch. Hostile environment in Corvallis. USC always struggles in Oregon State when they're highly ranked. I get nightmares of 08 on that Thursday night. I will always remember that. I want to hear your thoughts on that. And another thing I was thinking about earlier today, I was just thinking, what's a realistic, say Scott Frost does get another head coaching job next year. Any group of five or power five school you guys can think of that could be open? For me, I was thinking of maybe Colorado. Might be looking for a new coach. I think that coach is fairly new, but they've just been a disaster there in Boulder. So I think there is some opportunities for Scott Frost to be a head coach next year, but I was wondering if there's some schools you guys know of that might be able to take Scott Frost next year. Thank you, guys.
Well, you know, I will say that as someone who, you know, watched with like morbid curiosity the Larry Scott tenure in the Pac-12, it's nice to see that, you know, in a world that is constantly changing, some things don't change, which is the Pac-12 constantly shooting itself in the foot when it comes to scheduling. I remember, gosh, was it USC going to Washington State a few years back? And, you know, I think it was like a Friday night game. So short week, on the road, and it was just a terrible decision. And you know, they imploded, and Mike Leach got the upset. Ruined, you know, kind of killed the momentum that they had for that season, if I'm remembering correctly. So, yeah, USC going on the road and not getting a good scheduling assignment from the Pac-12, you know, it seems like it's just par for the course. As for Colorado, you know, anyone who expected a good thing to come from Carl Durrell being placed in charge did not watch his abysmal offense at Vanderbilt. I'm honestly surprised that he is employed in any fashion after that. I mean, like, when you said that it was bad at Vanderbilt, then it was truly, truly bad. So I'm honestly surprised that he got the job to begin with and that he's actually still employed. But I don't know, Bobic, if you've got.
Well, I've got thoughts on a bunch of things here. Well, first of all, I mean,
I'm going to turn it over to you.
There, for those of you out there who know anything about Nebraska and Colorado, that would be wild for so many reasons. Scott Frost would officially hate Nebraska if the first job he took were Colorado's head coach job, because those schools hate each other. People don't realize. Nebraska fans generally have amiability. They're known for that. I've been there for a game. They're very friendly to visiting fans. But Colorado is the one school where there's just so much mutual animosity between the two. It's the only one where they really – I mean, obviously Oklahoma, Nebraska, it may not be a very competitive game this year, but they're both fan bases are excited to restore that historical tradition with that rivalry game. But – no, Colorado and Nebraska, if Scott Frost took a job at Colorado, should it come open, that would be – that. I would love to hear – I cannot wait. If he did that, I would not wait – could not wait for the post on Reddit of comments of people from both schools on that kind of a change for so many reasons. But, yeah, no, some folks don't realize that. So when you made that suggestion, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, that would be nuclear. Now, all that said, I mean, Scott Frost, certainly, there's no reason I think he would find a job. I think if there would be people who would be considering him, especially in the G5 level, only because, for example, you can't ignore what happened at UCF. That was still a stellar season, a stellar turnaround to have that undefeated season. You know, we just saw, I mean, heck, he was unseated by the guy last year who was fired first, Clay Helton. USC was so happy to be rid of him. He lands at Georgia Southern. Everyone's like, kind of like, oh, okay. You know, okay, Georgia Southern, that's who you want. All right. You know, maybe he'll be okay. And look, he just upset Nebraska and got the first head coach fired this season. So, you know, it's possible maybe Scott Frost lands at a school. Could be a G5. I mean, what happens if suddenly FIU comes open? Is he willing to – that's a tall order down there, though. I mean, they're struggling in Miami over there. But there might be some options open. I could see some teams willing to do it, you know, although the news that just came out, Middle Tennessee won't be one of them. They just extended Stock still. That was a bit of a surprise for a lot of reasons. But I also wanted to just quickly go back to clarify – The game at Oregon State's not this week, it's next week. So this week, USC has a potential, you know, Fresno State's coming to town, and USC fans know exactly how the history of Fresno State and USC, going back to that Freedom Bowl that was infamous back in the day, to the incredible 2005 game where Reggie Bush single-handedly proved himself to be the Heisman Dynamo and put the entire team on his back against the you know, Pat Hill's greatest game he's ever had, you know, and Pat Hill was a great coach at Fresno State, but that was the peak of his career, and it kind of petered out after that. And he's still a good coach, and he's still very close to Fresno State. But, and I want to say Oregon State has actually a really fascinating game that a whole lot of people are talking about because it's FCS, but it's not, they're not taking on a weak FCS team. They're taking on Montana State, and they're number four. It's a quasi-neutral site. They're playing it in Portland. They're playing it at Providence Park, which is better known for the MLS team, the Timbers, right? Yeah, I think it's the Timbers. So that's kind of an interesting game. Montana State will definitely come in guns blazing. It's going to be fun. You know, historically, the two Oregon teams would play in Providence Park. It's kind of mix up. That was kind of their secondary home stadium, like we know with some of the schools in the SEC, like Arkansas and Little Rock and Alabama and Birmingham. That was their version of it, was playing in Portland. But, you know, those two games, they could be hiccups for both schools. So next week will be interesting. And I agree with you, the Pac-12 network, you might as well just say the game is classified. You might as well just say, we'll tell you the results afterwards. It's on Pac-12 network. And we can thank, of course, Larry Scott for that. Good news for Trojans and Bruins, you know, in a couple of years, you're going to be on the Big Ten network, which most people do have because they have a sensible TV contract and they never were crazy about how they arranged that. And they worked with Fox and didn't try to go alone. So that's at least the future positive as far as being able to see the games for those two programs. But I've been talking a lot here. Chris, Sirius, did you guys want to add anything? I think that is no. Cody, what do you think? I mean, we've also been blathering on about your thoughts. I mean, I think USC would probably be the stronger of the two, especially heading into the 24th. I would expect USC to take care of business, although I do know exactly what you're talking about. I had a nightmare in the Mark Sanchez game where he went there, you know, and that was, I think, USC's only blemish that season. I was the unlucky one who was abroad during that game. I wake up in a time zone where I wake up and the game had just gone final. And so there were no recap articles. There was nothing. I just look at my phone and I see USC is somehow lost in Reser. And the whole day I'm walking around like Istanbul thinking, what the hell happened? I have no idea what happened. I just saw final score and I was kept reloading my BlackBerry, whatever the hell it was. And thinking, like, what just happened? You know, this has got to be a typo. How did USC just lose in Reser? And no, they did. So, yeah, I feel you.
Yeah, and I apologize. I meant next week. Sorry for any confusion. But Fresno State's a good team, man. That quarterback's a gunslinger, and I'm not looking over Fresno State. I was just more pissed on the Oregon State thing because it's so recent. I get Pac-12 Network, you know, I pay for it like a instead of illegally streaming it, normal version, but I think the Trojans are going to win, but don't be surprised if at the fourth quarter, USC Fresno State, the 1-2 score game. I mean, I think that game's going to come down to all four quarters. Fresno State's a very, very tough team. I mean, Oregon State barely squeaked out of there, so I'm excited. I think there's a lot of good games this week. Just to change the subject just a quick second, you know, I've been reading a lot of people saying, oh, there's not many good games. I totally disagree. I mean, you got Michigan State, Washington, you got BYU, Oregon, Penn State, Auburn. Like this is a decent, you know, it's not the best week, but by all means, it's not a boring week. Like your thoughts on that as well.
I'll just add to that. I think you're right, because I mean, the games that tend to be the most exciting, I don't think anyone foresaw those three Sunbelt upsets. They were not the games people were looking out for. Of course, we got lucky that Texas, Alabama was, wow, that was an incredible game. We had some other good ones too. I mean, was it, you know, Pitt, Tennessee, several others that were just really entertaining games, but it's often those games you don't expect that kind of creep up and end up being, wow, that was a great week for college football. But when we say that, three of the prime games we talk about were on nobody's radar before Saturday. They were just kind of, oh, let's see if they show signs of life and we can kind of gauge how they might go into their own conference play, let alone upset. But Cody, man, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too. Hey, Samuel, you've been really patient. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey guys, thanks for letting me on. So I'm a student at Indiana University. This weekend we've got a doozy, probably a big time shootout. First 1-70 wins. We're playing Western Kentucky. I got to get up at like 8 a.m. and start drinking for that one. But my questions were, how good do you think Connor Bazelak is, and how far do you think he can take Indiana this year? Considering the first couple of games, it's been really a mixed bag. And then against Idaho this last weekend, the rain really affected his game. And then I know you guys were talking about group of five qualifiers for the New Year Six. And I was just thinking, one team that no one really has been talking about is Air Force. And from what I've seen from them, I don't see anyone being able to beat them, at least looking at the schedule down the line.
You know, a lot of folks have been talking about Air Force as a possible G5 for that. I mean, the G5 automatic qualifier for that reason. Their schedule looks reasonable. They've took care of business so far, and you know, well, they certainly, at the very least, they certainly seem to be the favorite for the Commander in Chief's trophy. They, Army and Navy, I mean, we love them, but they've definitely, this is not their year, and then sometimes they seem to go through that kind of feast or famine. In fact, by the way, Navy, gosh, there's a head coach I'm also wondering, is that one an unsafe position right now? But anyway, so Air Force, they got that just crazy. I mean, for them, that was a big deal. They didn't just beat Colorado, because, I mean, they're hungry to beat Colorado. They're in the state. You know, Colorado State's also there, but they're going to play anyway later on in the season. But they didn't just beat Colorado. They clobbered Colorado, which is part of the reason why everyone's wondering how long Carl Durrell's going to stay there. I mean, 41-10, just beating at home at Falcon Stadium. But they're definitely going to be one of the teams to consider there. I mean, perhaps the one thing that is going against them is their schedule is not as strong as some of the others. I mean, App State, if all they have is that firefight they had with UNC at the beginning of the season as the one blemish, but they beat Texas A&M on the road, and assuming Texas A&M can keep ranked throughout the season, Colorado certainly isn't. Colorado ain't going to be ranked at any point this season. You can take that to the bank. But I'm not sure. Because right now, look, Wyoming isn't very, very strong. Nevada just lost to an FCS program, a strong one. I mean, Incarnate Word's pretty good. Utah State is definitely off the rails right now. That was an insane loss they had to Weber State this weekend. The rest of what, UNLV, Boise State, you know, they're solid. Army's weak. New Mexico is still weak. Colorado State is still weak. And San Diego State, which could have been a strong contender, definitely, you know, they didn't have a good opener at Snapdragon Stadium with Arizona, so that's been one of the weak things there. So I think that could be the weak point in Air Force's resume. And we were just talking about the fact that App State will possibly have an undefeated Marshall team. I think that could be also a big boost for them if Marshall ends up being particularly strong in the end by the time they play them. But you know, you brought up some other interesting questions. You know, I admit I haven't paid as close attention to Western Kentucky because obviously Zappy left. So that was – or Zappy, wait. Oh, wait. No. Serious. Chris, help me out here. I'm totally – I think I just – wait, where do we go?
Yep. Bailey Zappy went –
Yep.
Bailey Zappe went pro, and so did his wide receiver. So, and his offensive coordinator went to Texas Tech.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, they've been kind of stripped bare there, but I haven't been paying attention to.
They don't seem to have lost too much momentum, though. Seems like they're still kind of continuing on from where they were. Obviously, you don't replace a player like Bailey Zappe, you know, just immediately. Even Bama would have trouble with, you know, that kind of turnover for someone who was that prolific of a passer. But it doesn't seem like they've lost too much momentum going from last year to this year.
This is going to be a real test for them, though. I mean, because, you know, Austin Peay and Hawaii, you know, not as strong. I know they – oh, that's right. Yeah, Inc., our good friend, that reminded us why they have such a strong quarterback. They were able to get the QB from West Florida, Austin Reed, who actually – he was the QB for them when they won the D2 championship in, like – I forgot, like year two or three at West Florida. Like, the program was brand new, and they managed to get there so quick. So – they do have a guy who was able to move up, and I mean, wow, that's actually astonishing because they got Zappe too from, you know, a lower division team. That's actually incredible transfer power for Western Kentucky. I mean, of course, I assume, I don't know how much of that had to do with following the predecessor there, you know, Zach Kitley, who was the offensive coordinator, who's now at Texas Tech. But I think it's going to be interesting for them. Obviously, they're going to test themselves against the Hoosiers, but I'm not sure there. What are you guys – serious, Chris, how are you feeling about Indiana?
I'm mostly just curious to see what's going to happen with them and if they can beat out Albert Pujols in the race to 700. Home runs for Pujols and 700 losses in program history for Indiana. Yeah. So, you know, we kind of tweeted about was it like 9 Windiana is what they need to hit basically in order to avoid it. So, Pujols is at 697, so it's getting close.
Yeah, I think Kentucky is kind of a wild card there. Only considering that, you know, coming off a win at a Hawaii team, myself and JD have a soft spot for Hawaii. He's from Hawaii, and they're a very bad football team this year, and so. I wouldn't read too far into a blowout for Western Kentucky recently. So we'll have to see what happens on Saturday.
Certainly Indiana's win against Illinois seems more impressive of the combined wins between the programs. I mean, beating Idaho is it's Idaho. It's now FCS, although I keep forgetting that. I still remember them back in the day. But that Illinois win, I mean – that's their only loss, and who knows, you know, we'll get a stronger idea of where that's going there. But, hey, Samuel, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. It's always fun to talk about these teams. Let's see here. Webb, you've been really patient. We'd love to hear from you, man.
I've got two things to talk about. The first one is, if BYU runs the table, do they get into the playoff?
Ooh.
Because that's a good – they have somewhat of a juicy schedule, and I think this team is pretty damn good. I'm an Ohio State fan, but I think BYU is a very good team.
Well, first and foremost, I mean, if anyone runs the table, they're all. I mean, it would be difficult not to have them in the playoff. And of course, they broke my heart last week on my alma mater in Baylor, and BYU's is a strong team and a hell of a home field. So, if they go undefeated, it would be really difficult to make an argument against them in the playoff. And
oh yeah, because that schedule not is just monumental. I mean, they've
got Oregon this week. They've got Arkansas later on in the season. They've got Notre Dame later on in the season, and then they have Stanford to close the season. Those are some big Power Five, and then another good independent team on their schedule.
Yeah, and they even have they have Boise State, which obviously isn't the Boise State of old necessarily, but it's still a solid Mountain West program. I mean, the weakest links are Utah State, which just ended up being, who knew Utah State was going to be that bad, but at least it's part of historic rivalry. And then they have a couple of, you know, at Liberty, you never know. That's Liberty has a habit of creating upsets, and I know this weekend this past weekend they took UAB, although UAB is a little shaky because obviously their head coach medically retired right before the season, but that was a bit of a surprise there. And yeah, if they can beat, you know, ranked Baylor, if they win this weekend, they'll beat ranked Oregon. They'll presumably be playing a ranked Arkansas. The Notre Dame game is a little bit of disappointment, but it's going to at least be an interesting game. It'll be higher profile because that's that Shamrock Series game. They're playing in Las Vegas because, you know, that's exactly where we expect that traditional BYU-Notre Dame rivalry to be, in the gambling capital of the world. But, you know, I love that game. That's going to be great. And you know that BYU fans are going to be representing there. I mean, BYU fan base in is going to show up for that Notre Dame game in Allegiant Stadium. So it's interesting. I mean, they have a good schedule. If they win out, I think they would be in the – it would be – unfortunately, you'd have to say who are the other candidates. If we have like if you have that perfect scenario where you have like four unbeaten P5 teams, or, you know, three and maybe a one-loss SEC championship loser, then you might have something interesting there. But BYU would at least have a strong argument because their schedule is solid this year with some good teams and some potentially impressive wins that would be on the road in addition at home. But again, they got Arkansas at home, so that's a big plus. But yeah. Webb, you wanted to add something.
And then my other question was, after seeing the footage from, I don't know what Texas A&M calls it, their midnight roll call or whatever, are we able to compare Texas A&M's fan base to the Branch Davidians with how big of a cult it has become?
Oh, ooh, somebody brought it up and wanted to go that way. Chris, I was about to tease you about that, being from Waco, but... but... I don't know. I mean, first of all, they're known for their silly antics. We love Texas A&M. We love their fans. They're fun, and they embrace – they know how silly it is, and they have fun with it sometimes. Some of them take it maybe too seriously, but every fan base is that, for goodness sakes. But for those who are unaware, during one of their midnight yells, they like to do these kind of skits and things, and they had a video, I think what they were calling the App State, you know, it was ahead of the App State game. They were calling them hillbillies, which some people, especially from the coasts, think it's somewhat ironic to have people from Texas A&M calling people from Appalachia, you know, hillbillies. But it was part of their skit, and the video got out, and people were having fun with it. And then I got to admit, they made an error, an unforced error. Somebody decided to go and file... DMCA, Digital Millennium.
Yeah, that was bad luck.
That was a bad look. So they basically got all these videos taken down. And, you know, so what happens? You know, most of the time, if you have a video taken, we've dealt with this many times in our history, and we've gotten good about steering clear of them. But if you get too many DMCA strikes, the computer will take down your website, will take down your Twitter account. And it's nonsense, and it takes a while to get out of it because you have to file appeals on every DMCA strike and say, and they let you know, but you have to say, like, here's the reason why this is wrong, or you have to click a couple of things and apologize for it. But it takes a while to get out of it. So you're just literally creating havoc for all of these other websites just because you're upset about, you know, something that's from a, you know, a cute, funny, funky, you know, midnight yell. I mean, something that they're known for, and it's nothing that crazy. But I just, my thought was, has anyone told anyone at Texas A&M about the Streisand effect, which is, you know, named after Barbara Streisand because when, long story short, when they were mapping the coast of California, which is actually public land in the state of California, somebody caught a photo of her house, and she got so upset about it that she created a legal fight. And then everyone in the celebrity news cycle picked up on it. So suddenly what she was trying to keep secret became worldwide news because they were taking photos of her house and saying this is why she wants to hide it. So that's the strike. That's when you hear somebody say the Streisand effect. That has become the name of when you do something to try and stop something, usually legally, and all you do is you drag more attention to it. And that's exactly what whoever was it, the source of the DMCA did, because Barstool jumped on it. Some sites quietly kind of take it and go away. Man, Barstool hit them right back and just embarrassed them, and that kind of that opened the floodgates as a kind of a open season there. Sirius, I know you wanted to add something to this conversation.
Well, you know, I did want to apologize for my Coastal Elite co-host who mispronounced Appalachia. Had to get that in there. But I think the most humorous thing about this whole DMCA nonsense, because, I mean, like, they're issuing strikes left and right. Like, someone basically has a full-time job right now trying to bat down all of these Twitter videos. But the stupidest thing about it is that you can just go on YouTube and watch the video on the official account from Texas A&M. That's how they're able to issue these DMCAs, because it's their video, which is still available for public view. I saw it earlier in the weekend, I guess maybe like late Saturday night, early Sunday, and I think it had, you know, 5,000, 7,000 views, and now it's up to 75,000 the last time I checked. And it's still going, you know, strong, and they didn't take it down. You know, if you were this embarrassed about people calling you out for mocking a school that then beat you, you know, maybe the first step would be like, oh, we should make this video private instead of just leaving it up there for, you know, God and everybody to watch. And Midnight Yells in general are pretty cringy, but this one is, even by A&M standards, it's pretty bad. Yeah, it's up to 120,000 views now in the, you know, half day since I last checked it. So another, was it like 45,000 views just today alone, just because they keep trying to, you know, chop it down everywhere on the internet.
Yeah, and not to harp on it, you know, too much more. I've got a couple of buddies from, you know, A&M. Again, obviously being in Texas, you're naturally going to know at least an Aggie or six that you're going to come across. And I think the general sentiment, yes, they're all going to be pretty corny jokes, pretty lame jokes. Still, my take on it was, you know, material 2 out of 10, delivery 3 out of 10. And you know, I think you gotta just take the L and move on, right? I thought it was kind of funny how some of my A&M buddies were a little bit, you know, perturbed about the backlash, and I could see their point that, I mean, it really is just a small segment, you know, it's just a video, but at the same time, I think everyone's got the right to kind of poke fun and laugh at how badly this has backfired simply by not just shrugging it off and taking the L. Sometimes that's what you got to do.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And, but Webb, thanks for bringing that up. That was definitely a topic we were wondering if it was going to come up today, because it's part of the silliness of college football. I think, again, and I have to emphasize it, these types of stories are fun because they're just ridiculously silly and the stakes are so low and all of that. But Webb, man, thanks for joining us. Those are some fun topics to cover, man.
Yep. Have a good night, guys.
Yeah, you too. Hey, Justin, you've been patient. What's up? We'd love to hear from you.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Great. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk some Penn State football. I'm a Penn State fan. Actually taking a road trip up to the Big House this year. I'm hoping it's not a 49-10 game like with McSorley and Barkley, even though they ended up winning the Big Ten that year. So hopefully it's a little more closer. But bringing up those two teams, actually, after seeing, you know, Harbaugh give, you know, McCarthy the keys to Ann Arbor, watching Drew Aller a little bit in that Purdue game and then seeing him play the second half of the Ohio game, you know, I'm kind of hoping Franklin goes that direction. I don't think he will. I'm not the biggest Franklin guy. I like him as a recruiter, a great recruiter. Not the biggest fan of just, like, coaching in general. But I know if he played a lot this year, I think it would set them up a lot better for next year. We know another a year with Aller and full year at Singleton. I think Singleton's a beast, but do you think it would help them if, you know, they go that Michigan route and give Allar the keys, you know, going into Big Ten play and, you know, maybe winning 10 games? I think they'll beat Auburn. I think they'll win that Michigan State game at Penn State at the end. You know, good Lord, maybe an upset against Ohio State or Michigan, doubtful. But, you know, just watching the way Allar plays compared to Clifford, and Allar just throws the ball so effortlessly, and Clifford just, you know, he just looks nervous every time he drops back. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Oh, I thought Sirius was good. Oh, there you go.
Yep, yep. No, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with the James Franklin experience, speaking from personal experience, is that he's not an X's and O's coach, really, despite being a past offensive coordinator. He is very much kind of like a program leader, you know, enthusiasm builder, recruiter. He gets guys hyped up. He makes them think that they can win, which sometimes in a program, that's what you need. You know, if you've got a team where guys have been close, but they just couldn't get over that mental hurdle at the end, he's very good at the motivating aspect of it. But when it comes to X's and O's, he really, really depends on who his coordinators are. And he's had some roster turnover there in the coaching staff. And you've seen the impact on the field. I think that's kind of why you've seen some setbacks in recent years from what you would expect from Penn State. You know, for a guy like Clifford who's been there, he's put in the work, and he's shown pretty good ability on the field. You know, it's always risky if you want to make that decision to bench a returning starter, because some guys, they can handle it and they can realize, you know, this is a challenge. I need to elevate my game, get back and take the reins back, prove that I am the person who should be the quarterback for this team. But for some guys, it's just such an ego killer and a confidence killer that once they lose that starting position, they're completely demoralized and they can't get it back. Which then, I mean, if LR is, you know, the next great Penn State quarterback, that's fantastic. He's thrown 12 passes this year. You know, that's a big gamble to make if you aren't confident that he is for sure the one to go with. And that, you know, you're risking losing Clifford either to the not to the transfer portal at this point, most likely, but, you know, losing him as a leader of this team if he doesn't take it well. And him basically, you know, what if he checks out? Because right now, I mean, you know, his pro prospects aren't that great, I don't think. If they were, we wouldn't be talking about him being potentially benched. So, you know, I think I'd want to see Allar get some more reps in some bigger games. You know, hopefully they can get some leads to where they can put him in, you know, in the second half of the game to see how he does against, you know, better competition. But that's always a gamble to try to, you know, switch horses on the way to the apocalypse kind of thing.
You know, the thing that struck me today was reading that, I think I forgot which site, but his Heisman odds are now, Drew Allar's Heisman odds are better than Sean Clifford, which is, that's got to be, I mean, that kind of info gets spread around. That's got to be a bit of a hit on the ego. Cause, I mean, he's got like 101 odds, while Sean Clifford's got 250-1 odds to win the trophy. And coincidentally, and again, this is from Onward State. I like to always say where I'm here reading this from. But Onward State points out he has the same Allar has the same odds as former Penn State quarterback Will Levis, who's now at Kentucky. So where he's 2-0, obviously, and Kentucky, we were just talking early on in the show about how good the Wildcats are looking. So that's that part, building on what Sirius said, definitely would make me a little bit concerned for how that's going to make him feel. But of course, you know, we could be wrong. Clifford could step up, and, you know, sometimes that's what it takes, just a little bit of competition to make that kind of put that fire in someone. Justin, I know you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying about maybe like his ego and all that. But part of me, I know he has that big like NIL business he's working on, and not really working on it. It's actually doing pretty well, I think. And he's, part of me thinks like, you know, that's, he knows that's his route in the future. And I know you said Alar only threw 12 passes, and understandably so. It is a big gamble, but you know, I'm just talking about just, you know, watching just the way he looks. He looks comfortable. I know it's Ohio, you know, but even those, you know, four passes against Purdue, you know, it just looked effortlessly. And I feel like every time I watch Sean Clifford, I'm just waiting for him to get hit the wrong way. And, you know, he's out in the locker room just like last year in that Iowa game. But he just looks nervous back there, and understandably so, with just his injury history and with him doing so well with that NIL gig he's got going. You know, Franklin might be under, they might be in like mutual agreement perhaps that we don't know about. That's just what I'm thinking, though.
Yeah, I think it starts with the reps. Oh, sorry. I think it starts to your point with reps. I mean, it's got to start at practice, I think, before it translates to the field. And I don't know, that's a tough pull to make, but big risk, I guess, enormous reward. So, Justin, are you kind of saying that maybe it's a confidence issue in terms of stability? I mean, literal physical stability, kind of dropping back with that history of injury?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, people who watch, you know, every full like Penn State game notice that. And, you know, before the year started, you know, I said, you know, just let Alar sit, you know, just kind of sit under Clifford, get that year, you know, just, you know, get redshirt that year kind of, and just, you know, just Clifford with the experience gives us the best chance to win 10 games or pull off an upset. But, you know, I feel like he walks out with that, you know, brace on his leg, and just, I can just see an accident waiting to happen, you know, with just, it takes one hit with him. So, yeah, to your point, yes, that is kind of what I'm saying here.
You know, it kind of makes me think of what we saw with Derrick Rose when he came back from injury, and he lost so much of the explosiveness, and part of it was that he lost it from the injury itself. But then, especially after the second one, he was mentally scared. Like, he lost explosiveness, not necessarily from the physical part of the injury at that point, but he was afraid of trying what his body was actually capable of, you know, pushing it to 100%, and he was backing off of it because he'd been injured and he was so scared of getting a second one or a third one that you could see it in his gameplay, and he was not the same player. And it took him, you know, several years, and you kind of saw it with his role as a sixth man, that he was able to finally get past that and adapt to what he felt comfortable with and what he felt his body could do and what he trusted it to do. And he had to adapt his game in order to follow that. So I don't think it's uncommon to see players that are coming back from injuries, especially that impacted them in the game itself and had a big impact on their team, where they're looking at it as, you know, I'm worried about getting hurt again. I'm going to play extra safe because I would rather play cautious and play the whole game than try to be risky and have another injury, you know, this massive turnover play, and my team doesn't have me for, you know, the rest of the game or the rest of the season. So I think there's some factors there that are in play, and maybe that's something that is a confidence issue that he just builds up as he gets, you know, some more actual playing time, because, you know, everybody will tell you practice speed and playing speed are totally different and they don't really correlate. And the only way to get experience in a game is to actually play the game. So, you know, maybe it's something that he's going to be able to get that back. Maybe he won't. We'll see.
Hey, Justin, I wanted to thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it. We're going to go ahead and slowly wrap up here. But, Chris, you came back up. We'd love to hear your thoughts before we close this out.
Thank you again. Thank you again. I just had two little small questions, open-ended questions for you guys. I was thinking about – it's funny that you said it when I asked the question earlier about who's on the chopping board next, and you said Carl Durrell. And the light bulb for surely came on. I was like, yes, he is. I seen his game this last week. Oh, my God, Colorado looks horrible. It looks like typical Carl Durrell. I mean, as you know, his stint from UCLA. And then also, too, I was going to ask for Florida, the state of Florida, in the next 3 to 5 years, I don't think the state, nowhere in the state of Florida has 3 years, but what program do you think out of all of the Power Five schools there, you know, Miami, Florida State, and Florida, which one is going to be relevant again? And then lastly, I wanted to say, and then let's say future. I'm talking about 5, 6, 7 years now. Do you think Urban Meyer will ever come back into coaching, or do you think his career is completely written off? And that's my end of my questions.
Well, I mean, certainly I think no one is going to write off Urban Meyer completely. There are going to always be teams desperate enough to deal with the baggage that'll come there, because he's certainly proven, you know, he can win. I mean, back at Bowling Green, back at Utah, back at Florida, and then at Ohio State. So certainly his track record, as long as you're not in the NFL, speaks for itself. So there will probably be teams that will tease that idea, you know, whether or not there'll be a meeting of the minds in what salary he wants and what teams are willing to make that effort and have boosters who are willing to take that and bite onto that at the expense of perhaps some negative, you know, PR that's going to be associated with it, and the hope that wins will erase that. There'll always be, I think, programs that are willing to do that now again, but that is a lot of hypotheticals there. I think, and, you know, you brought up, oh my gosh, I totally slipped my mind. Guys, what was the, Chris, what was the other half?
Yes, I'm giving you loaded questions here. The other question was just about the state of Florida. It's very open.
Oh, right. Gosh, you know, that's a really good question, because it's hard to predict, because obviously Florida is still Florida as far as recruiting. All those programs still have the cachet. I mean, we've got interesting situations at both. I would say, obviously, Florida State's the one that might be the most questionable. I'm not saying in the future whether they're going to be successful or not, but they have the other two have new head coaches, so it's a little more unclear where Florida State is right now, and if losses start to happen, will they decide to go a different way? Oh, gosh. But, you know, Miami, the funny thing about Miami, and I don't know how much of this has changed, they were a lot like USC, at least, oh gosh, 20 years ago, when Pete Carroll took over at USC, and Miami was, you know, the Miami everyone remembers, the unstoppable beast, you know. The funny thing is both those schools have so much in common, being private schools in cities and warmer climates where the rest of the fans or the public are kind of a little more fair weather. They don't always show up. You know, those are, and UCLA has that problem too. Don't get me wrong. We saw exactly how bad the attendance was for their games, but and of course we do know there's heat there, but there was also heat in the Coliseum, and they showed up a little bit better down there. But, you know, both Miami and USC have always historically have problems with, oddly enough, trailing in facilities, because they were so long reliant on the fact that their name, USC and Miami, were big, that the facilities they had for their student athletes wasn't always as good. And that's what allowed Oregon to climb out. That's what allowed some of the other programs to climb up, because they were like, well, why don't we dump a bunch of money in here and entice some of these recruits? And it worked. And now both those programs have probably caught up. I know USC certainly caught up, and I assume to some extent Miami has too. That was always a bit of tension within that program in getting that in some of the previous head coaching regimes, you know, vis-a-vis the presence of the university. And now they have a president of Miami who is into supporting that program. But I think ultimately my thought goes to Florida being the most likely to rise and be prominent again by the very nature that it's in the SEC. It's going to get SEC money. The other two are for better or worse, still in the ACC. So that's not quite the same. I mean, the money that's going to get thrown at Florida year after year with that, with the TV contracts they're going to pull in, with the level of that super conference that they're in that we're now seeing as the Big Ten and the SEC, that's going to always give Florida a leg up until the finances change otherwise to the benefit of Florida State and Miami, who, which are potentially attractive targets if, you know, if I'm thinking about adding a team. I mean, the Miami market is certainly a strong one, and Florida State definitely draws, you know, eyeballs from across the state of Florida, being as populous as it is and being as market a useful market as it is. Although, of course, the question is, do you get enough of it from Florida already? But setting that aside, I mean, Billy Napier, he's a great coach. We're going to see, you know, obviously last they split a pair of really interesting games. I mean, we were all before the season really curious how that Utah game is going to go. And it was a fight, and Florida pulled it out. And we weren't shocked. Playing in the Swamp is difficult, and Utah put up an effort, but it wasn't enough. And then, of course, Kentucky managed to pull it. I guess I wouldn't know if it's an upset yet. It was so early in the season, but Kentucky looks like it's a program on the rise. So my personal bet among the Florida teams is, you know, the Gators. But I don't know, Sirius, Chris, what do you two think?
Yeah, I think that Florida is probably the safe bet just because of the institutional support that they have. You know, Dan Mullen got fired, but he got fired despite having, you know, it's because his results weren't good enough, not because they were that abysmal. You know, it wasn't a Scott Frost kind of situation that led to him getting canned. And Billy Napier certainly seems to be off on the right foot. I will say that Florida State looks, dare I say it, competent, finally, which is refreshing to see. You know, it's college football is better when you have those three schools in a good place where they can compete with each other. So it's nice to see them making some progress, being able to go out and win that LSU game, which how many times have we seen it in the past few years where Florida State would not have won that game, you know, would have tripped over their own feet somewhere along the way. And then Miami is still a pretty big question mark for me. I want to see what Mario Cristobal is doing there. They looked pretty good the first two games, but I want to see them face some actual stiffer competition first before I make a decision. Florida sitting there 1-1. Yeah, they lost a game, but Kentucky, as we discussed earlier in the show, you know, it's a team that is a program that is on the rise, not your dad's Kentucky. Very much improved from what they've been historically. And, you know, it's still a respectable loss right now. Obviously, we'll see how the season shapes up. And that Utah win could look even better by the end of the season. But I think that Florida right now is in the better position of the three.
Yeah, and I say this despite having friends and family perennially chanting SEC, you know, in my face, my ears. But yes, I mean, I think the as you said, it's safe money is on Florida. However, I will not count out Miami, especially with an impressive looking, at least on paper, recruiting class for 2023. And we'll see what comes about in 24 and such. But yeah, it's really tough to, bet against the big, yeah, thanks. Great. My loved one just wrote a piece of paper. It just means more. So more SEC teasing in my face as I'm doing this damn Twitter space. it's tough to bet against that. But like I said, a lot of talent. Miami's loading up, and I think you'd, for a state like Florida or a Texas or a California, it's good for the state and good for the sport when there are multiple teams competing at a really high level. It makes college football that much more fun.
Well, Chris, thank you for joining us in that. We're going to go ahead and start wrapping up here. We went for an hour and a half, which is a little longer than we typically go, but there were good questions, and we always enjoy hearing from the rest of you. You know, before we wrap up, Sirius, Chris, is there anything you're looking forward to this weekend? Is there a couple of games or a game that really just sticks out for you?
Amy, Joe's like, give me just a second to, my research team is on this.
I can go ahead and say there's a couple.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm really interested in this. I totally hit mute, didn't I?
I thought the show had just crashed or something.
Oh, I know. No. And I've had that happen before. But no, the games that got me excited for sure are, you know, Miami at Texas A&M. I'm excited about that game. We were just talking about those schools. That's going to be one that's going to show us where Miami is under Mario Cristobal. And Texas A&M is smarting after that loss, and they're definitely looking to prove themselves. UTSA at Texas, I'm really excited for that game because Texas left it all on the field against Alabama, and they suffered some critical injuries. UTSA had that wild overtime game with Houston in week one. Now they have that good win over Army, another battling game, but they would love nothing more than to beat University of Texas at San Antonio. Would love nothing more than to knock off the team in Austin. So they're going to put it all out there. That game, I'm really curious to see how that goes. And we're going to also see exactly how well Texas bounces back with a difficult loss, with some losses on the field that they're not going to have for this game. Michigan State, I know someone brought up that game, Michigan State at Washington, one of our callers did. That's an exciting one. Goodness. I mean, and, you know, oh, gosh, there were a couple more I wanted to mention here, and I'm totally blanking myself.
BYU-Oregon, obviously.
Yep. Yeah, BYU-Oregon, that's probably the highest-ranked matchup in terms of ranked-to-ranked, I think, or at least it's competitive. And Oklahoma at Nebraska, I'm just curious to see what happens at Nebraska. What do we see there? We talked a bit about how they're going to look under an interim head coach. You know, that's going to be a big question there. I mean, they certainly – we're going to be looking to see that. I mean, that's the fun thing about college football. We're going to get quite a few weeks to see how they behave in the wake of the Scott Frost firing. And, you know, Friday's got a couple of games. We've got two, actually. We've got Air Force, who we were just talking about, at Wyoming. Unfortunately, that game's on CBS Sports Network, which I do get, but I know it's kind of a rare station to get. And Florida State at Louisville. That, to me – that's a game I like because I still remember 2002. It was like my first year of grad school. I was at a bar, and I was just watching the TV on a Thursday. And I'm like, hey, everybody, look, Florida State might lose to Louisville. When Louisville was still a G5 program trying to rise up, I think it was Conference USA at the time, Florida State had somehow agreed to go play a Thursday night game in Louisville. And they lost, and that was like a program-defining moment for the Cardinals. So, you know, that matchup, I'll probably mention it during the game. I think they always do when Florida State plays over there. But that, I remember that game. I watched it, and that was just like, holy crap, this is actually happening. Florida State is falling out there. But, you know, Chris, I know you had some games you wanted to mention to that too.
Yeah, so I was really trying to look up and down, trying to find one a little bit more offbeat. And I'll be honest, hey man, shout out to my wife. We both love college football, and we were looking at this list, and she found at Kansas at Houston. That is only a 10-point spread, and Kansas obviously coming off a 55-42 win over West Virginia, showing that the Kansas Jayhawks are able to score points, which is not something we've always been able to say in the past, nor have we been able to say a 2-0 Kansas Jayhawks team. So that I think that might be one to look out for. Mid afternoon game, ESPNU. So, you know, if nothing else is really lighting up the scoreboard or anything, that might be one to look at.
You know, Kansas is getting dangerously close to not being must-watch sickos TV content. And I don't know if I should be happy or sad about that because it's, you know, it's like seeing your little kid grow up and go off to college. But I think also that was one of the games that I was thinking of for the Big 12 is that Kansas-Houston matchup, with Houston coming off of that loss against Texas Tech. You know, Mike Craven was on here. His hot take that we asked him for was Houston going undefeated, running the table. Obviously, that's not going to happen, but it was a non-conference loss, technically, still, at least for another, you know, year or two. But following right on the heels of that, going and hosting Kansas, and, you know, are they going to come out a little punch drunk from last week, or are they going to come out with a point to prove to make sure that, you know, Texas is the only team that loses to Kansas in Texas. And then the second game I had from Big 12 was Texas Tech and NC State. NC State obviously is making some moves. We've talked about them in past shows about how, you know, this is kind of the season for them to do something, you know, with what looks to be a kind of a little down on their luck Clemson. Texas Tech coming off of that big win against Houston. Joey McGuire, friend of the show, has them off to a good start at 2-0. So it'll be interesting to see how they do on the road against NC State when we know that this is a Wolfpack team that is out to, you know, make a statement this year and try to do big things. And, you know, potential kind of like a spoiler maker kind of season for Texas Tech if they can go in there and come out with a win against NC State, or a chance for NC State to prove what kind of a year they're going to have.
Yeah, because this is going to be NC State's chance to really prove themselves. They, what do they have? They had a 55-3 win over Charleston Southern, which is a perennial, you know, the reason why Jeremy Chadwell got hired away by Coastal is because he turned them into a FCS playoff contender that one year. But that one point loss to East Carolina, and we know East Carolina is one of those teams you cannot sleep on. They will pull an upset on you, and they will go absolutely – They leave it all on the field, but that 1 point loss, we don't know how. I don't know where NC State even is right now. So
that's one point win.
So yeah, 1 point win. Pardon me, a 1 point win over East Carolina. I'm not sure how they're going to be. So Texas Tech is going to be a good way for them to prove it. Yeah, and just to build on that, Houston before that loss, they were the leader. Everyone thought they were the biggest opportunity for a G5 team to get that AQ spot was going to be Houston. So they've lost already. Kansas, they still have an outside chance of climbing back up. There have been historical examples of G5 programs that have had that, you know, early season loss and then climbed their way back up. But if they lose a second game, they're out 100%. So they are hungry to beat Kansas for that reason. And, of course, KU is trying to show everyone Lance Leopold is the real deal. He is the real deal, no doubt. I mean, he's a dark horse candidate, we thought, even for Nebraska. But yeah, I mean, I know, Chris, you had one more you wanted to add, Pac-12 after dark that we should look out for.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, hey, you know, USC and Fresno. USC, again, only a 12-point favorite, and crazy things happen in Pac-12 after dark. So just a heads up for that one. And Utah also hosting San Diego State. It's on paper, yep, 21-point favorites, but – you never know. So if you're up late and have nothing else to do, they want to check those out.
Yeah, those are good ones. I like those. Oh, my gosh. And how could we forget? North Dakota State's playing at Arizona. This is the first time in years North Dakota State's been able to arrange a P5 program. That's huge. North Dakota State, as some of you may remember, has a habit of taking war trophies from P5 programs to the point that no one and G5 programs to the point that FBS programs were kind of ducking them. We had the AD of the Bison on the show, friend of the program, last month, and we kind of talked to him about that. It's kind of hard for you guys to get these programs back on the schedule, but this year they're going to Arizona. Arizona isn't exactly looking particularly as weak as they had before. They're not as anemic, but man, this is not. I know a lot of folks are curious to see if North Dakota State can do it again, because they're North Dakota State. We all know how strong they are. Anyone who knows FCS knows exactly how strong they are. So that is definitely one that I'm looking forward to on Saturday night when we're talking Pac-12 After Dark. And that one's going to be on FS1 too, so it's going to be nationally televised. So Wildcats better bring it, because a Bison will just run right through you, and I'm curious to see that one. Well, thank you to all of you out there. This was another RCFB Talk Tuesday night show. So on behalf of all of us, on behalf of Chris Darrett, on behalf of Sirius, on behalf of myself, Bob Akhayeri, thank you for listening. We always enjoy hearing from you. And now I'm going to hang up and listen.